landed in jail. Look out, boys, they come down fast. Baby addiction of the wicked class. In your heart or in your home, never have to be alone. Woman doors and wild attack, anything to catch a man.
Hello, this is Stark Raven on Vancouver Co-op Radio. I'm your host, Tiffany Chong. Coming up on Stark Raven, we bring you the story of a failed experiment in privatization. Ontario Corrections is taking over Canada's only private prison. We'll hear about what went wrong and what it means for other prisons. And in our special feature, we'll hear from the Six Nations people in Caledonia, Ontario, from the latest political squabbling that's holding up the land claim process, and the people and prisoners who are left in the lurch. And in our news, we'll tell you about the dramatic increase in the number of adults held in prison on remand, and a report that says the Canadian prison system discriminates against Aboriginal people. All that and much more here on Stark Raven. Canada's only privatized prison has been officially handed back to the public. The Maximum Security Central North Correctional Center in Penetanguishene, Ontario, has been run by the U.S.-based Management and Training Corporation for the past 5 years. While the company argued that they could save the province of Ontario millions of dollars, they still couldn't convince Ontario's Correctional Services Minister to renew the contract. This has been welcome news to Sharon Dion. Sharon's group, Citizens Against Private Prisons, has been trying to stop the privatization of Central North Correctional Center from the start. Sharon joins me on the phone from her home in Penetanguishene. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
How are you tonight?
Doing great, thank you.
So how do you feel about the prison officially returning to the management of Ontario Corrections today?
Well, I'm ecstatic that the contract will be terminated this week, actually. so it's been, you know, it's been a long, hard fight, but I have to say Canadians should be very proud that, you know, we've taken back control from this American company.
And I understand the handover is going to be stretched over a six-month period. Do you know what exactly has changed today?
Well, actually, the date, they're taking, the ministry officially takes over on the 10th, which is
Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So, what do you have a sense of what changes will be made on the in the first week?
Well, actually, they'll be hiring a lot more staff. There seem to be a lot of problems with security in the facility. The contract from the beginning, when the Harris Conservative government put the agreement in place, it was completely flawed. They didn't really consider, you know, the security part as well as they should have. They didn't have the staffing levels that the ministry have, and I don't know why they allowed this American company to operate with far less staff. And inside the facility, you know, correctional officers were being beat up. One in particular was beat up so badly he has a head injury, he'll never work again. You know, we've had inmates being beaten badly, inmates not getting the proper medical care. One was murdered, and we're talking, you know, a provincial 2 years less a day facility. So, you know, they just did not have the staff to keep everybody safe inside the facility, and that's one concern that, you know, the Liberal government had concerns about that, actually a huge concern. So, you know, their first priority, I believe, is getting more staff inside to make sure the facility is safe and that our community is safe. MTC at one time had an internal document, confidential document, was leaked out to me, and it stated there that, you know, because of they were non-compliant with the contract and many times on staffing levels, that our community was even at risk at times. So, you know, when they're saying that within their own company and, of course, not wanting us to find out, I mean, this is serious stuff. And unfortunately, you know, when it's a private company, they're there for profit, and that's they're in the business to make money, and, you know, their shareholders don't ask, you know, how safe is everyone inside, you know, are there better recidivism rates, how are the staffing levels. They don't ask things about those. They don't ask things like that. They just ask, how much money are we making?
Now, it sounds like there were some pretty serious problems within this prison.
Extremely. You know, it was an ongoing battle. Staff inside were always in fear of losing their job if they spoke out against MTC. Nurses were in fear of losing their nursing license because they were asked to do things inside that really they weren't qualified to do. So they were always in fear of losing their job, and many of them are so pleased now it's going back into public hands. They now believe that they'll be safer. Families of people that were working there were calling me all the time. You know, I'm in fear of my husband's life. They just did not have the security that they should have.
Now, this was all started as a sort of experiment.
Yeah.
To compare it to sort of a similar-sized, similar facility, publicly run prison.
Right, right. When the Conservative government first put this into place, they were, you know, the plan was to build so many super jails within the province. So the first one built, of course, was CNCC. That's our jail here in Penetanguishene. That's the Central North Correctional Center. And then they also built the Central East Correctional Center, which is publicly operated. Now, this is the first time in all, you know, in history that a apples-to-apples comparison has been made to two identical facilities. In the United States, I've read many studies about, you know, how they're trying to do comparisons, but it's really difficult if they're different types of prisons. So this is the first time that this has ever been done, and that's why, you know, so many people who have researched private prisons, the private prison industry, you know, they were just waiting for this study to come out, and it's the first time anything's been done, you know, so close as the two facilities being the identical. They're identical jails, and MTC basically failed in most categories.
Do you think it was worth it to have this experiment, even with the loss of one of the prisoners' lives and all these other problems?
Well, you know, when you phrase it that way, no, I don't want anybody to lose their lives. But I think the American private prison system, these companies are here to stay, and they will rear their ugly heads all the time. You know, they are failing actually in the states, but it's the federal government now, the Bush administration, that is trying to utilize them more now. But because of the different states and county jails that are now backing away from them because they've had so many problems, they're going throughout the world now to see if they can fool everybody else. Well, the fortunate thing is they didn't fool the McGuinty Liberal government, and I really have to commend them for doing the study, and, you know, it was an open, honest comparison, I believe, and it was difficult to get the information out of that jail. Even our government had a hard time getting paperwork out of that facility. You know, they would make excuses, well, we've, you know, so-and-so's not working here anymore, he must have it, we've lost it. So they didn't want to give a lot of the information to the government, but this government wasn't fooled, which I'm really, really pleased about.
Now, you mentioned the Bush administration and sort of the federal government in the states pushing for private prisons. And in some ways, there's a bit of a parallel with, I guess, the Harper government and their get tough on crime legislation. Exactly. How do you think this will impact sort of that plan?
Well, I know the American companies have been lobbying the federal government for private prisons. I have written a few letters to the Prime Minister, and of course I have you know, tons of documentation of why you shouldn't, you know, they should not do this. But again, you know, you've got these big American corporations that will, you know, that will give donations. There's a lot of corruption that follows these private prisons, which I have documented as well. You know, many million dollars of bribes to different governments, to different counties, to different people. So I'm really hoping that, you know, the governments of this country will see that this is not what Canadians want. I think we're really proud of our standards and values that we live by, and I don't really believe people want to be Americanized with this private prison system.
Also, every so often, over the years, I've heard of other provinces like Alberta and in the Maritimes, provinces talking about the possibility of opening their own private prisons. Do you know what the status is on that?
Yes, actually, there was a task force that came from Alberta that visited our jail, and they came back with a conclusion that they found it wasn't as economical as their system, or they just felt that they didn't like what they saw. There wasn't enough staff. They felt that staff need to integrate with the inmates for rehabilitation. That's part of the rehabilitation, and they didn't feel that MTC was doing this. Now, also, the province of Quebec was looking at this. They came and toured, and they thought it was a pretty fine facility. You look at the facade of it, it's, you know, the shiny, shiny floors, because they have the inmates out cleaning all the time, you know, till 2 o'clock in the morning when they know someone's coming in to tour. But at the same time, they didn't realize there was a murder. They didn't realize that an inmate had died from substandard medical care. They didn't know correctional officers had been beaten up. They didn't know there was a huge riot that, about 100 inmates were rioting because they didn't have medical care. They didn't have the proper food. They didn't have clothes. I mean, these guys are doing it, you know, they're in here for, you know, an average stay of 66 days. Why would anybody riot to that extent? And it cost the taxpayers over $1 million to repair the facility. MTC did not pay for that. The taxpayers of this province paid for the for the damage that they had to go in and redo the whole unit because of that. And I spoke with an inmate that was involved in that, and he said we had it. You know, we weren't getting our food till sometimes 10 o'clock at night. Medical care wasn't being looked after, and you know, inmates had it, so they were trying to make a point that this is just not the way it should be, and that's the problem when you've got this private company. They just cut back on anything they can to make a profit. Now, you know, when you look at the comparison, MTC did operate at a far lesser price than what the public system has, but at the same time, you know, I've got a stack of lawsuits that, you know, inmates are suing MTC and the province because of the problems that have occurred in there. So, you know, I don't think that was included in the study as far as what it's going to cost us. But, you know, there's a lot of things that the government had to consider. The recidivism rates were higher in this facility than at the publicly run facility. So there's a lot of things that, you know, they did see as major concerns, and again with security, recidivism rates, and medical care, which, you know, MTC really failed at all of these. So that was a good reason for them to take it back.
Do you think these problems are just inherent in the fact that it was a privately run prison, or do you think we should be wary of what will happen in the changeover to the publicly run management?
Absolutely. I mean, the public prisons, they are not perfect, and I will be the first to admit that. But when you put a profit motive in with dealing with, you know, high-risk people that, you know, are in need of help, it doesn't work. It hasn't worked in the United States, and it hasn't worked at our own, you know, at our jail. And I think all of the Canadians have had better see what's going on in these American with these American companies. They just do not do the job. Like, I'll give you one example. I had a call from a local supplier who brought fruit and vegetables to the facility. MTC, usually in a case of apples, it's 125. MTC called. They want 150 in a case. Then they wanted 175, and he said, I can't put 175. These apples, you know, they're going smaller and smaller and smaller. So, you know, in turn, instead of having, you know, the larger apples at 125 per case, they wanted 175. So the apples get smaller. But it shows the government that, you know, they are getting their, you know, so much fruit a day, but they don't say what size of the apples are. And that's how they save money. They can feed 50 more inmates an apple. Just little things like that. And that's why inmates were rioting. They're hungry. And, you know, I think as a Canadian society, we realize that, you know, these people have, you know, their human rights have been violated drastically. So, you know, I really believe that's why. I think, you know, we as a society are smart enough to manage our own prisons. I don't think we need to go to the Americans and see what they can do for us, because they just can't do the job. They're not doing it in their own country, so I don't, you know, they're not going to do it here either.
Do you know how the staff inside the prison are feeling? Is there going to be a complete changeover of staff, or will they just be hiring more staff?
No, they will be keeping the majority of staff on. There have been maybe 24 people who will not be keeping their jobs for one reason or another. They've weeded out some people that have had problems in, you know, taking too much time off. I know one person in particular. He was hired to combat bad media. The government did not keep him on because there's really not a position for him now. So there have been a few people that have lost their jobs. Unfortunately, I mean, I don't like to see anybody lose their job, but at the same time, they need to weed out those who weren't doing the best job, and they will be hiring a lot more people.
One thing I have heard from someone is that Central North Correctional Center actually had more programs for prisoners than other provincially run prisons.
Yes, they did. And, well, again, this is what this private company can do. Everything looks great on paper. They have wonderful policies and procedures in place on paper, but they didn't have any action on them. Now, they had that's the one thing that they, you know, really, really were proud of, were these programs. But at the same time, they didn't have the enough staff to classify inmates to put them in the proper programs. So they didn't do as Lindsay does. They have programs, as they say, the programs that work. And they got these inmates in their programming, and the recidivism rates were lower in Lindsay than in Penetang Machine. But all MTC wanted to do was say, look at this, we've got these programs in place. You know, we have so many inmates going through them, you know, every day or every week, and we look really good. But they didn't have the outcome that should have been. Now, another program that these inmates If they went to medical to get their medication, that was a program. If they went to the chapel, that was a program. And MTC were paid a little bit more money every day for these people to be in programming. So to me, it was a farce. Unfortunately, it didn't work. And I also had, you know, a social worker say to me, you know, we do this one program, which is a six-week program, and we ask that, you know, we're really not making any headway in 6 weeks. Could we extend it to a 10-week? MTC said no, because they just want these people going through the programs. They show the government that, look at all these people have gone through this program, and that's what they do. They don't care about the outcome. They just want these inmates to get through the programs, so they get paid more money, because they were paid more money for programming.
Now, this marks the end of, I guess, any fully privatized prison in Canada. But I guess there are different layers of privatization. Can you tell us about sort of the gray area in between the publicly and privately run services inside prisons?
Well, I know a lot of, you know, some of them will subcontract, you know, the food services, and some of them are even thinking of doing that in programming as well. But, you know, it's a really tough thing to do, I think. The government has got to stay in control of what's happening, in every department. And I really hope that they, you know, they find their way to do that.
And now that Central North Correctional Center is back in public hands, I mean, you started your fight specifically around this prison. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do now?
Well, I continue on, because, as I said, I know these companies will rear their ugly heads in another province, and I've got the, you know, I've got the research, I've got the knowledge, and, you know, I can direct people on where to go, and anyone who does come across this, I really urge them just to fight as hard as they can, because this is not a good thing for Canada. Prisoners become private property rather than public responsibility, and that is the wrong way to go.
What was it about this fight that that made you get so involved and get so committed?
Well, at first, you know, when the government was looking for a host community for a super jail, I thought it would be a great idea, because we have the mental health center here, and you know, I was never in fear of any safety issues, and I thought it would be good for the economy of our small town. And then I heard the word privatization, so I thought, well, who if not the government would be accountable? And then I just started, you know, looking up these companies, not even knowing how many they were. And when I did, I was appalled at their dismal track records. And the amount of corruption that follows these companies, you know, many of them, and including MTC, you know, have bribed governments to get contracts.
Wow.
And actually, a couple of the fellows who worked on the government's RFQ, the request for qualifications, MTC paid them to go to Hawaii. 1 month after they completed our contract, MTC hired these two guys to better educate them on how to get a contract, because they had lost three in the state of Florida. So, you know, they worked for our government, and then MTC hired them to, you know, to better educate them on how to get a contract after they completed ours. And then MTC got our contract. These guys knew what was in the contract.
Hmm.
Exactly.
Well,
corruption. And this is what we don't want.
Definitely.
And, you know, MTC's, you know, I'm working with a fellow in Texas right now, and he's battling MTC. You know, he has proof of a $3 million bribe MTC has made with a judge to get the facility. So it just goes on and on and on.
How do you think citizens and the public can fight this tide of privatization?
Well, you know, it just takes determination, and I think if you have the knowledge, which I have, you know, I knew nothing about corrections before I got into this, and it was basically a full-time job for me. researching and just finding out as much as I could about, you know, MTC and the other big companies as well. But I was really focused on MTC after they were chosen here. But the information is out there, and if anybody, you know, wants to check out our website, I'm also with the Private Corrections Institute, and it's registered with the state of Florida. And these are actually my American colleagues who have really educated me on everything. And that website is www.privateci.org, and that's for privatecorrectionsinstitute.org. And there's just an enormous amount of information that's documented on that website with the private companies and what's been going on. So it's amazing the information you can find out. I was invited to participate in a conference in Nashville in September, and it's sitting around the corner with all, you know, these American people that have been doing private prison research for years, and they are just so knowledgeable. So I really have to thank them for everything that I've learned, and I will continue with that organization as well. I'm the Canadian liaison for that, so I really do want to keep involved. And like I said, if any other provinces are looking at this, they can contact me, or they can, you know, go to the Private Corrections Institute and get some information from there.
That's great. Well, thanks for all your work, and thanks for joining us tonight, Sharon. That was Sharon Dion of Citizens Against Private Prisons. She was speaking to me from Penetanguishene, Ontario. You're listening to Stark Raven on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. Stay tuned. We'll be back after in the last half hour with news from Six Nations and Caledonia.
A Spaniard prisoner given a chance to be free as a conquistador finds himself in the so-called New World without his Spaniard woman and among conquest subjects already perceived as subhuman. He picks and chooses an indigenous woman. He rapes her and has children. These children he does not care for, as they are half-human. He beats a woman when she refuses his orders. He abuses the children when he wants to and when they get in his way. And now, 502 years later, the descendants of the ultimate dysfunctionalism, a blueprint for the colonized. Seven generations of cycle of illness, of people without heads, without an identity, without a direction, without an understanding, and without a connection. Torn from their mother and raped by their father, now lost in a sea of white, they begin to recover, recognize their identity and connection to these roots. These roots that run deep. Deep in the soul of our mother, 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 deep in the soul of our mother.
My blood is red. So that track was My Blood is Red, and the group that does that track is Azalant Underground, and that song is from Redwire CD, Our Words Are Our Weapon and Our Bullets Are Truth. And I'm Marge Lamb here with you today on Stark Raven.
And I'm Tiffany Chong, and you are listening to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. And coming up next, we'll bring you Stark Raven news. And now it's time for the news here on Stark Raven. The Federal Ombudsman for Prisoners says that the Canadian prison system is practicing systemic discrimination against Aboriginal people. Howard Sapers calls the situation a national disgrace. He detailed the findings in his annual report that was released last month. The overall incarceration rate for Aboriginal people is 9 times higher than that of the population at large. The situation is even worse for Aboriginal women. 1 in 3 prisoners in federally run women's prisons are Aboriginal. Almost half of them are being held in maximum security. The report highlighted further evidence of this systemic racism. Native prisoners are routinely overclassified. They are far more likely to be sent to maximum security prison than non-Native prisoners. One of the consequences of this is that people are being deprived of access to programs they need in order to get paroled. When Aboriginal prisoners go up for parole, it is routinely denied or revoked, often on technical grounds. This means they serve longer time behind bars. Also, Aboriginal prisoners are more likely than non-Aboriginals to be sent to solitary confinement. Sapers also noted the young age of many Native prisoners. 40% of the Native prisoners are under the age of 26. Native groups welcomed the report and appealed to the government to remedy the situation. Though many were skeptical about the chances that anything would really change, they expressed frustration at the worsening situation despite the dozens of task forces, internal reviews, and other reports that have been compiled over the years. Despite Howard Sapers' report and the statistics, in response to the report, Public Safety Minister Stockwell Day says there is no evidence of systemic discrimination against Native people in the prison system. Though the annual report focused on the situation for Native prisoners, Howard Sapers also touched on a wide range of other problems. The correctional investigator repeated calls for better services for prisoners with mental health needs. The proportion of prisoners with mental health issues has more than doubled over the past decade. The report also expressed concern about the state of health care and the need for timely investigations and follow-up in incidents of serious injury or death among prisoners.
The 6 tattoo parlors in prisons across Canada are sitting idle after being in operation for less than a year. The federal government says it is reviewing the program and deciding if it should continue funding the sites. They have not set a timeline for the review. The program's goal was to educate prisoners on safer tattooing, infectious diseases, and infection prevention. Selected prisoners were also trained to perform tattoos. The $700,000 program came from the Public Health Agency of Canada. For more than a decade, there have been calls for safer tattoo sites in prisons. This call comes out of the reality that, despite it being illegal, prisoners have been performing underground tattoos for years. Studies have shown that tattooing performed in unhygienic conditions risks transmitting HIV and hepatitis C. And the rates of HIV and hep C infection amongst prisoners is staggering. Prisoners are 7 to 10 times more likely to contract HIV than the outside population. The odds of contracting hepatitis C are 30 times higher. Prisoners and activists question how the impacts of the program can be assessed when it was only up and running for several months. They have also expressed concern that the conservative government will not continue the program for ideological, not evidence-based reasons.
The composition of prisoners in provincial jails has shifted dramatically over the past decade. The number of adults held on remand has increased while those in sentenced custody has decreased. The numbers have shifted so dramatically that there are now almost equal numbers of prisoners who are on remand and those who have been sentenced. In contrast to this almost one-to-one ratio, only a decade ago, the ratio of sentenced adults in jail to those on remand was closer to 3-to-1. According to the Statistics Canada report, one of the reasons for the shift in the composition is the increasing amount of time served in remand in Canada. Statistics Canada says the trend could be a result of tougher requirements for granting bail and more complex criminal trials that take longer to resolve. There has also been an increase in the use of conditional sentencing, meaning that more people are serving their time in the community rather than in prison. Many community activists point out that increasing remand populations mean many are serving sentences even before they have been tried in court. They argue that this is a denial of the presumption of innocence.
Justice Minister Vic Toews is upset that the Commons Justice Committee is making changes to one of the bills from his law and order agenda. Bill C-9 was introduced in May. It was designed to do away with conditional sentencing, such as house arrest for a range of crimes considered serious. MPs from the three federal opposition parties on the Justice Committee joined forces to pass several amendments to the bill. The changes would limit any future ban on the use of conditional sentencing to serious crimes of violence. Critics maintain it would do little to deter crime. Instead, the result would be overflowing jails and costly new prisons. NDP Justice critic Joe Comartin said that Tory government can accept the changes or ignore them and try to force a vote in the full Commons on the original bill. He predicted a vote on the original bill would lead to a defeat of the legislation. The other option is that the Tories could simply refrain from calling the bill for a final vote in the full House. This move would basically mean abandoning the legislation.
And that concludes Stark Raven News for tonight. And the future of the Six Nations land claim in Caledonia, Ontario, is up in the air this week as politicians squabble who is responsible. You'll hear more about that later in the show on Stark Raven. This is Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Sa ugat ng kasaysayan. before I was born. I had a name before I was born. It is whispered by the waves, sung by the poor, danced by the wind. I had a name before I was born. It is forged by fire, strengthened by metal. It is carved on the roots of history. I had a name before I was born. My name is freedom.
And now you're listening to Stark Raven on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. And what was that song we were just listening to, Marge?
We were just listening to Lani Tagaza. She's the artist, and it's her demo CD, actually, that my brother sent me from Toronto. And that track was called I Had a Name Before I Was Born.
Do you know where she's from?
Montreal, I think.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It was really lovely.
Yes.
Now for our feature, we're going to be talking about Six Nations, the land claim there in Caledonia. This week, the Federal Minister of Indian Affairs, Jim Prentice, or actually this was last week, he backed out of a meeting with Ontario's Aboriginal Affairs Minister, David Ramsey. That was last Tuesday. They were supposed to discuss the land claim dispute in Six Nations Caledonia, which has left the town divided by violence and barricades since February. Aboriginals from Haudenosaunee territory have reclaimed land that they say was sold using a false contract. Prentice says the Ontario government is responsible for footing the $40 million cost of the dispute because he says the land purchased was purchased prior to Confederation. Ramsey says that land claim negotiations have always fallen under the jurisdiction of the federal government and that Prentice is essentially passing the buck. While the bickering continues, though, several members of Six Nations have been behind bars for months. We're going to play an update for you that's was recorded by CKUT Radio's Fiona Beckman. She interviewed Janie Jameson last week from Six Nations.
I'm speaking with Janie Jameson. We're speaking from Ganistatun at the Protected Place. If you could just give an update as to the situation for the political prisoners of people who have gone inside for defending the land here.
Okay, so far we've had approximately five arrested. Three of them were held in custody. Two have been released, one a young offender. I think he was 14 years old. He was released, but he ended up pleading guilty. One of the charges was assaulting a police officer. Another one, Ronnie Gibson from Akwesasne, he was released on $10,000 bail. And there's a third that's being held, Trevor Miller. And we have no idea why he hasn't been granted bail. All of them, as you stated, are political prisoners. It has nothing to do with alleged crimes that have happened. But in regards to those three individuals that were incarcerated, to my knowledge, they've all had their rights violated to different degrees. And frequently it was being interrogated without legal representation. One of them was a diabetic, or he is a diabetic, and even upon his arrest, we had told the police that he was diabetic and dependent on medication. He went without that for 3 days. They made him wait 3 days without giving it to him. And while he was incarcerated, he wasn't always given his medication on a daily basis, and his glucose readings weren't done at the mandatory intervals they should have been. And not only that, but he was well aware they're putting sugar on his food. So the only way for him to stabilize his blood sugar level was to stop eating. And the few days before his release, again, he wasn't given his medication. Things like that, not only their rights as individuals, but international rights have been violated in this situation. So far, there have been 32 arrests, well over 65 charges laid, and because there are ongoing investigations, we believe there's well over 25 unexecuted warrants, and that number is still building. We're in dire need of financial help for legal, for our legal protection, or for our legal battle. Because like I said, we have no idea how many more have to go through that system, or who's wanted, or who's going to be apprehended tomorrow. We have no way of knowing that. It's kind of on a day-to-day basis. Like even myself, I'm wanted on an outstanding warrant, and I can be picked up at any time, you know. And just last week, I was in a car accident, and I had my children with me, and I'm 6 months pregnant, and I had to deny myself and my unborn child medical help because that threat of me being arrested was there. And there's, on top of that, you know, despite the trauma of my children losing a brother to a car accident recently, that trauma was there, and I was trying my best to deal with that. Never mind trying to hide from the OPP on the scene, you know. So our lives have been turned upside down, you know, and we've never done anything wrong. We've always abided by our constitutional law, the great law. We've always abided by our natural law, and there's no law that supersedes the natural law. There's no law greater than that the Creator has given to us, and that's what we're here upholding, you know. And there's no crime in that. There's no crime in defending the lives of our children, of our future generations. That doesn't go against any law. And I'll reiterate a quote I heard recently by Martin Luther King. And it's in respect to this constant violation of, or what Canada calls, Ontario calls, a constant violation of the Canadian criminal law, the Canadian law, the Canadian Constitution. You know, those are all supposed to be laws that citizens of Canada are upholding. But they have to keep in mind, in upholding the Canadian Criminal Code and upholding the Canadian Constitution, what laws are they violating against Indigenous people? And the quote by the late Martin Luther King Jr. was, "Any unjust law is no law at all." So with that being said, that's my final words. Our own law, the Kaina Lagoa, is a very just law. It's a right law, and it's a right that every person in Canada has an obligation to uphold. Yeah.
Considering that the people of Six Nations are in dire need for financial aid in terms of for the legal battles, where should people send checks to in terms of helping out for this?
Janie Jameson, RR1 Oshwegan, OHSWEKEN, Ontario, N0A1M0.
And that was Janie Jameson in Six Nations, Caledonia, Ontario. She was speaking to Fiona Beckman of CKUT Radio. And this is Stark Raven on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. And Marge, you're going to pick a song for us next?
Yes, the last track for today is Volcano Woman by Skeena Reese. And it's off the Redwire CD, Our Voice is Our Weapon and Our Bullets Are the Truth.
Allow me to introduce myself. I am Volcano Woman. I am brown. I am pissed off and ripped off. I'm silent and I'm screaming. I'm dealing with it. I'm not playing games no more. I'm fighting to live in a world that hates me and everything I represent. I am Indigenous to this land, you wannabe Tony Millionaire hating punk. I am not a victim. I am a survivor of genocide. I am a warrior. I am an historical manifestation of the cunning, the most cunning. I'm going to crawl into your head. I am raising the next generation on truth. I am raising my hand against you in defense of you. I am thinking differently. I am making plans. I am doing things. I am turning off the television. I am turning the channels. I am changing the levels. I am producing the producers. I am weaving. I am writing. I am thinking. I am helping. I am stopping. I am starting. I am coming. On my way, on my way. Volcano woman's on her way. So you had better get out of my way. So you had better get out of my way. I'm on my way. And whether you can dream it or not, believe it or not, I'm on my way. On my way. On my way. Volcano woman's on her way.
And that was a great little song called Volcano Woman by Skeena Reese. And that concludes Stark Raven for tonight. If you should tune in next week when we'll be back again at the same time on Monday, November 13th, where we'll be talking about the fight against the youth super jail in Brampton, Ontario, and we'll be speaking to members of the 81 Reasons campaign. We'll also be giving you an update on the case of political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. And on Monday, November 20th, you should tune in again as we'll be talking about the Tory plans for a three strikes bill. And if you want to find out more about Stark Raven or read some of the news that we announce on the program, you can go to our website. It's located at www.prisonjustice.ca, or you can also email us and at stark-raven@cooperadio.org. You can also send an email to that email if you'd like to find out about what's going to be coming onto our program and receive our email digest each month. We do air on the first three Mondays of each month from 7 to 8 p.m. here on Vancouver Co-op Radio. You can also hear us live on the internet at the same time at www.cooperadio.org. And the show is also rebroadcast on the station on Wednesdays at 5 a.m. And if you have any immediate questions for us, you can always call us right after the show at 604-684-7561. Again, that's 604-684-7561. And we just want to remind you that Stark Raven is a 100% volunteer-run program, and we rely on your donations to keep the show on the air. So if you're interested in becoming a member of Co-op Radio to keep this show on the air, call us at 604-684-7561 to become a member today. And we're going to leave you now with a song. But first off, I just want to thank Marge Lamb and Louise Croft for helping with the production of tonight's show. See you next week.
Join us for fun and good times at the Community Living Show every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on CFRO 102.7 FM on your dial. Dealing with today's issues for special needs people throughout BC. The Community Living Show. Don't miss it.
Before the rain comes down. fingers burn. Black magic has returned.
Dark as the night, sick as the girls.